You're listening to El Clásico, the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España from Barcelona to Madrid. Today, we are in Valladolid.
You are indeed listening to El Clásico. My name is Daniel Freiber and I'm the host of this episode. And I am in Valladolid, where in the early evening of September the 16th, 1965, around 300,000 locals reportedly witnessed a flying saucer soaring above the city, making it one of the most notable incidents in the history of Spanish ufology. And where late this afternoon we saw an identified flying object in white, red and green tearing through the city streets. Here to reveal the identity of said rocket ship and review all the other action on today's 10th stage, the individual time trial, is the Cycling Podcast's own answer to Buzz Lightyear or Buzz Aldrin. It's Lionel Burney.
I wondered where that was going. Hello, Daniel. You made it. You made it to Valladolid. No problem. 5-hour drive, went without a hitch. Didn't have to kind of slow down and then go round again, like one of the planes that the riders were on. Tell us a little bit about the transfer.
Well,
drama.
First of all, my transfer was pretty uneventful. Probably had a few too many stops. Rather overindulged in the Repsol, that's the main chain of fuel stations in Spain. Overindulged in the stops at Repsol garages. Otherwise, it was pretty uneventful, Lionel. There was a bit of evidence of the damage around Madrid that we'd heard and read about. There had been some flooding on the roads, and there was still sort of a cleanup operation after all that. But no real problems, I must say. That reminds me, though, Lionel, in relation to the problems we heard all about, one of the riders planes being, well, diverted, wasn't it? It was supposed to land in Valladolid and it ended up landing in Madrid, to the consternation of those on it, obviously. I did mean, but I haven't had time yet, to go through the results of today's time trial and tabulate who was on plane number one and who was on plane number two and see if there was any pattern there.
Lidl Trek were on the plane that had to, basically, it was coming into land and then soared away back up into the sky and went to Madrid instead. I was a little bit sketchy on the details of who.
I know the Lidl Trek were definitely on that plane because someone from the team explained it to me, described it to me, recreated it in quite sort of graphic and thrilling detail. This afternoon, that the plane was about to touch down and then it reared up again. I do know that King Kenny Elizonde had a nice lie-in yesterday till midday, but some of the riders, in spite of having got to the hotel well after 3 in the morning, were up with the larks up at 8 o'clock, so no real change. But I think it did change quite a few riders' plans for the rest day. I heard reports of quite a lot of riders, which is unusual, not riding at all yesterday.
Yeah, and other riders grumbling that there wasn't enough to eat. They didn't really get a proper meal. So no wonder they were raiding the press room buffet before taking off.
Well, yeah, I was going to say this is good practice for their reconversion into the life of journalism, their post-career plans to take our jobs and become journalists.
All 176 of them will be doing podcasts in somewhere between sort of 4 and 10, 12 years' time. That's actually happened to me before, coming into land and then suddenly the power goes back on and go up and go round and do another loop. It's really not pleasant, I have to say. Not a relaxing way to transfer up to, well, the centre of the country after 9 hard days of racing. Doesn't really get the rest day off to a restful start, does it, for them?
No, Lionel, not ideal. Also not ideal, and we'll hear Ryder reflect on this later in the podcast. It's the fiestas de verano, the big sort of end of summer party season in Spain, and over the next couple of weeks we are certainly going to encounter quite a lot of them, and they're in full swing in Valladolid. And it's a lot of fun, and there are a lot of people in this very beautiful city, and there were a lot of people out last night, and it was pretty loud and pretty raucous until very late at night. And the riders, of course, won't be able to enjoy any of this.
Well, they never can they? Well, although having said that, there have been some fairly famous stories of riders overindulging, heading to nightclubs. The Vuelta really is the holiday Grand Tour, the nightclub Grand Tour for some of them. Famously, was it Andy Schleck or Frank Schleck? I don't want to defame one
Andy
of the Schlecks.
Schleck.
Yeah. Get the right Schleck who went to a nightclub. Yeah, but that's a story for another day, I guess.
Yes.
And it's all too serious. All too serious now, isn't it?
Well, it is, and this has been a bit of a theme of our Vuelta coverage. I've alluded to this on several occasions. I've had quite a few conversations with riders and coaches over the last few days about just how serious it's all become and how there is really no scope for any of that monkey business anymore. Lionel, talking of stories, shall we, without further ado, proceed to the story of the day, otherwise known as the tale of the etapa.
El resumen de la etapa. The tale of the etapa.
Thank you, Daniel. Yes, well, the only individual time trial of this year's Vuelta, Valladolid to Valladolid, 25.8 kilometres. Not the most inspiring course, I didn't think, televisually. I mean, parts of Valladolid that we saw look really lovely. I'll ask you about that a bit later on, what you thought of the course, but it was a good racing course, I thought. You know, it wasn't too technical, but there was enough of a technical test to, so it wasn't just horsepower, and although it was predominantly flat, it wasn't just as a drag strip test. But well, what happened? Well, the first rider to break the 50 kilometer an hour barrier was Clément Davy of Groupama FDJ, and he led until Hugo Page of Intermarché overtook him. And then I suppose the first of the serious time trialists, Stefan Bissiger of EF Education, first had a brief spell in the hot seat, and then it was over to the identified flying object you talked about in his red, white and green, what was it, flying saucer, Pinarello branded flying saucer, Filippo Ganna, the Italian time trial champion, of course, one of the best time trialists in the world. He set the best time and then spent a long time in the hot seat. He had enough time to listen to, I think I worked out, 3¾ episodes of the cycling podcast Vuelta coverage while he was sat in the hot seat. Not sure he was doing that.
No, but Lionel, I was picked up, one of the Ineos Grenadier staff members escorted me, frog marched me to Corrections Corner this afternoon. I was accosted because I think I said yesterday or 2 days ago in the podcast that Galicia was in France. This was obviously just a momentary lapsus. Anyway.
You know Galicia is not in France. They didn't take you back to the spaceship and, you know, interrogate you or, you know, some kind of unpleasant probe going on. Let's leave that analogy there, shall we? After that, it really became a race for second place, didn't it? And a lot of riders got close to Ganna in succession. They were Nelson Oliveira, the Portuguese rider with Movistar, and then Matteo Cattaneo of Sudal Quickstep, and then Alexander Vlasov of Bora Hansgrohe, and then another Portuguese rider, João Almeida, was briefly in second place. And we were all waiting, weren't we, for the big guns. Primoz Roglic didn't beat Ganna's time, and nor did Remco Evenepoel. But the interesting thing is that Evenepoel was second, 16 seconds slower than Ganna, and crucially 20 seconds quicker than Primoz Roglic. And he kind of did the reverse split business, didn't he? Because he was very narrowly down on Roglic at the first check, but then up at the second check and third. And apparently, I did have a little look to try and calculate this, but he was the fastest rider over the third section of that course between the last checkpoint and the finish. So he clearly was turning the gas on at the end.
I think that had maybe more to do with aerodynamics than it did with any pacing strategy. I think that was always the part of the course that was likely to suit him.
Well, either way, he had a good day in the time trial. Not surprising. He's wearing the rainbow jersey as current world time trial champion. What else happened? Well, a very good ride by João Almeida, who was fourth, ahead of Vlasov, Cattaneo, Ayuso, Marc Soler, who is still up there for UAE Team Emirates overall after finishing eighth. And then maybe a little bit disappointing for Jonas Vingegaard in 10th. Sepp Kuss, though, 13th in the red jersey, keeps hold of that red jersey by 26 seconds from Marc Soler. Remco is now at 1:09 and Roglic is at 1:36. Lenny Martinez had a decent day. He's still in the top five, 2 minutes two down, and then come Almeida, Vingegaard, Ayuso, Mas and Vlasov rounding out the top 10. Not unexpected, Mikel Landa tumbled six places in the GC, but he is not a noted time trialist, and this probably was the least favourable type of time trial course for him. And that was the time trial, and tomorrow there's another uphill finish, but we'll talk a bit about that later. The key headline, though, is, well, we said we were going to look at the GC after the time trial and see where this leaves Jumbo-Visma and, most pertinently, Sepp Kuss. And, well, I guess that would be the subject of our discussion in one of the subsequent parts of the podcast,
yes.
Daniel.
Yes, Lionel, it will indeed. And just to add that I think the scenes after the finish line always tell us quite a lot about, not so much about how the riders feel about their day, but about their personality generally and how they sort of go about their business. And Remco Evenepoel is quite fascinating to watch after today's time trial. You know, there are a lot of riders that come in after time trials, even riders who are contending for the victory, and they are completely oblivious to where they finished, where they are in relation to the winner. And Primoz Roglic, I don't think, had the times. He's much more sort of self-contained, much more focused on whatever narrative is playing out in his own head that we're often not really privy to, and it's quite kind of indecipherable when he tries to talk to us about what he's feeling and what he's felt about his ride. Whereas Remco Evenepoel, you know, people talk about whether it's sportsmen or celebrities being present and having this great ability to be present and sort of laser focused. Remco Evenepoel comes over the line as he did today in the time trial and immediately is sort of digesting and computing and asking for information and well, we're going to hear from him in just a second. All of this kind of gets fed through the internal Remco computer and, as I say, processed very quickly and with this, as I say, laser focus, which is quite impressive to watch. I think, please don't get me wrong when I say this, but the one rider, if I had to pick one rider from the past who he reminds me of in only in this respect, it would probably be the controversial Lance Armstrong.
Interesting that. Yeah, I think a very good friend of mine once described me as being the Ladybird book of body language. I think I probably said that on the podcast. You can tell from sort of 50 paces away what kind of mood I'm in.
50 countries away at times.
Well, on Sunday, you certainly could, Daniel, at least a few countries away. Anyway, and I think, you know, Remco really does wear his heart on his sleeve, doesn't he? There's no pretending, there's no hiding what he's thinking in any moment. And I find it strange that he gets a rough time from some people about that. I certainly wouldn't reproach him for... I think it's a waste of energy if you're trying to win a Grand Tour, but... that's his personality, and I think he injects a real kind of, you know, his own lifeblood into proceedings, and you learn a lot about other people as a result of looking at the race through the prism of Remco as well, because we saw it a bit last year, but certainly seeing it this year, he's under a lot more pressure, and you can sort of see that pressure coming to bear. And I think it would be fascinating to know, you know, be inside Remco's brain to find out what he really thinks about the GC tonight. But let's see if we can ascertain anything from his from listening to the sound of his voice here at the finish. Can we decipher how Remco's feeling?
Lionel, first we're going to hear from Sepp Kuss, one of the winners of the day. Then we're going to hear from Remco Evenepoel. And as a little footnote, as a bit of a bonus, we're going to hear from Geraint Thomas, just because he had some interesting things to say. His time trial today, fairly unremarkable by his standards, 20th place, 2 minutes drift off Filippo Ganna. He's well out of the general classification, but yeah, there's a couple of interesting nuggets here from Geraint Thomas.
Yeah, it was a tough day. Had to suffer a lot. Usually when I do a time trial, I just kind of back off when I feel too much pain. So it was a new experience, but really nice just to be in the red jersey. I felt actually not nervous at all, just because I wanted to enjoyed the day, and I knew that no matter what happened, it would be a unforgettable experience being the last guy off the start ramp wearing the red jersey with all the people cheering me on. And that was really beautiful to experience, and truly gave me a lot of power today. Yeah, it's still a decent gap, but so much can happen in the mountains. In the first half of the race, it's always a game of seconds, but in one stage it can really blow up. So we'll have to see. But for myself, I feel really good, feel really confident, and Primoz and Jonas are looking really good as well, and they're also giving me a lot of confidence and helping me out with a lot of things. So overall, the mood is really good.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. Knowing that I didn't really have the best time trial legs today was a difficult moment after 10 minutes. So I think that's the reason why I lost some time on people. But I think if a guy deserves this stage win, it's him. So I think overall we should be happy with the GC result. But of course, it's a pity we don't take the stage today. But I think two times second and already a stage win in the pocket is pretty nice for the first 10 days of this Vuelta. Let's say we have to be happy with the GC gaps that I took today, the GC lead that I took today, and also coming quite closer to Sepp, who did actually a super good TT. So big congrats to him as well. Yeah, I think they told him to just go all out today, to try and not lose too much time, because of course they want to play the game with the 3 leaders. So I think he did a very good job, and like I said, big chapeau to him, because I was pretty surprised when I just saw his finish. But then in the end, it's still a very long Vuelta, and many more opportunities to come, so we'll try to go for it and keep on building and thinking about how last weekend went, and also today. I think I've been showing 3 days of good levels, so we have to keep on building with that, and then try to hope to take some more time in some other stages.
I attacked it at the start, I thought, even if I sit up halfway around, I think it's still doing me good for tomorrow, because if I don't do much, I block up and I can feel terrible. So a good hit out was what I wanted anyway, and I actually felt okay. I was kind of doing the numbers that I sort of was on the plan. But then, the chain got stuck between the 11 and the frame, so I had to change bikes, and then I was just like, I'll just still push a bit, but, switched off a bit then, rode it in, and treated it as a nice little warm-up for the rest of the week.
Garrett, how are you going to approach this week?
I think as a team, we just have to start every day like it's a one day, really. I think try and make the moves, and because you never know, a breakaway might go, but same time, it might be GC day as well. But I think we just need to, just race every day as best we can, and keep believing in ourselves, because, it has been hard, to be honest, because a lot of things have gone wrong. But that's the way it goes sometimes. We just got to keep our heads up and keep trying, and that's all we can do.
And just the last thing, Garrett, totally different to the Giro time trial, last Giro time trial, but you mentioned that day about the bicarb, and it hadn't maybe worked in your favour that day. Have you changed anything on that front for time trials? Had a bit of a rethink?
Yeah, I'm not having bicarb again.
Really?
And, it's something I used to use on the track, and then I didn't use on the road because I always retain the fluid. But obviously the last day of the Giro, it didn't matter for the next day, so I used it. But yeah, the sensations were, I think you need to use it a lot to really, for me anyway, to get used to it. But I'm definitely not using bicarb again. But there's a few learnings from that day, but yeah, it's the way it goes.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, Lionel, it's a beautiful evening, and what's been a beautiful day in Valladolid. I'm just on the banks of the river here, the main river that flows through Valladolid. I think it's called the Pisuerga River. And as you mentioned earlier on, it's a very beautiful city, Valladolid, with some very fetching, grand monuments, some of which were on show, I think, on the TV on today's time trial. and excellent crowds, really excellent crowds. I don't know how common it is. I mentioned the fiestas de verano, the summer party season, which is a sort of phenomenon that covers the whole of Spain. I don't know how common it is for people to work. Most of the shops are still open. But as I say, there were certainly a lot of people at the roadside today, which was great to see.
I was more taken by Geraint Thomas talking about bicarb, taking or not taking bicarb for a time trial effort. And it's quite an interesting phenomenon, isn't it? This is sodium bicarbonate. And it is, I think, proven, there's been studies, haven't there, proven to help reduce lactic acidosis in kind of intense endurance style efforts, but not over a long period. So that is why, I mean, the first I heard of it was track riders taking it, particularly team pursuiters, individual pursuiters, to try and reduce some of that lactic acid build up. So no bicarb for Geraint Thomas. Good thing too. No bicarb in Welsh cakes. There's baking powder in Welsh cakes because
this is it, isn't it? Go
the
on.
Big confusion.
This is the eternal. This is the eternal debate, question, puzzle. Is it just me, or every time I look up some kind of domestic hack usually about how to remove stains on the internet? It always suggests one of the two. Is it baking soda or is it baking powder? It's the one that no shop ever has in the UK, at least. In Germany, it's quite easy to get it, I think, the substance we're talking about, and it's called Natron, which is a much better name. It sounds much more kind of exotic and like it is something which would, you know, propel you in rocket fashion.
Yeah, it's not a catastrophe if you mix, mistake one for the other in baking, I don't believe, although they do have different properties. I did hear, I don't know whether this is one of these urban cycling myths, but years ago somebody told me that a British time trialist took baking powder instead of baking soda before a time trial and had no real effects. I mean, that rose up lovely by the finish line. They were a delightful light sponge by the finish line, but it didn't improve their athletic performance. But bicarb, Geraint Thomas is off the bicarb, I guess, then after the Giro experience.
There's riding en souplesse, as the French say, out of the saddle, and there's riding like a souffle after heavy doses.
Souffle instead of souplesse.
Lionel, just staying with Ineos for a minute. Obviously, well, fantastic day for them. And Filippo Ganna, was he your favourite today?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I did think Remco would push him close, and of course he did in the end. But I don't know, Ganna as... he's able to, focus on this stage, isn't he? I mean, he hasn't had to, I'm not saying it's been easy for him, but he's not been pressed into other service, particularly for Ineos Grenadiers. And midway through the Vuelta, I thought, given the type of course, he would certainly be the favourite. I mean, it was basically a half-hour effort, wasn't it? So half an hour record for him. And never really in doubt. I mean, yeah, there was nothing at the earlier time checks that meant that I thought he would have to stop listening to back-to-back episodes of the cycling podcast in the hot seat there, or put down his novella, or whatever it was he was doing to pass the time. A very good stage win for him, and it kind of gives Ineos Grenadiers a bit of a boost after, well, a disappointing... I guess disappointing opening week for Geraint Thomas, who had his troubles again today, didn't he? I mean, the bike change. He seems to be sort of plagued by misfortune occasionally.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a rotten Vuelta for... It had been a rotten Vuelta for Ineos so far. Of course, they've lost Laurens de Plus, they lost Tymon Arensman. Geraint Thomas has had his issues. Egan Bernal has crashed a couple of times as well. Ganna talked about all of those things in his press conference today. He also talked about having wanted to come and really specifically requested
to come here to the Vuelta because he wanted to help Geraint Thomas. Well, Geraint Thomas didn't need to redeem himself after the Giro, but of course he had a near miss there, an agonising near miss when he was pipped by Primoz Roglic. And Ganna wanted to come here to make amends with Thomas. That's not going to happen with Thomas. We heard Thomas there saying that they're going to treat this week as a series of one-day races. So it'll be interesting to see what that looks like with Geraint Thomas. Geraint Thomas is not a rider who's often done that and had a lot of success doing that. You know, we mentioned Richard Carapaz, how he salvaged his Vuelta a España last year by doing precisely that, going for mountain stage wins and pulling it off on the whole. But that's what Thomas will be, well, certainly attempting to do. Lionel, Ineos on time trial days, well, there's always a lot of activity around the bus, as there is around all of the buses. And a phenomenon we've seen in the last few years is that a lot of teams fly in a sort of special team of experts, or at least one specific time trial expert. Jayco Lula, for example, have Marco Pinotti, who always makes an appearance on time trial days. And at Ineos Grenadiers, of course, it's Dan Bigham, their aerodynamics time trial boffin, I suppose you could call him, genius guru. And he was there at the Ineos bus before the time trial today in Valladolid. Dan Bigham, of course, is the gentleman that helped Filippo Ganna take his own hour record, take Dan Bigham's own hour record in Switzerland in last October. Anyway, Lionel, I thought it'd be interesting to find out a bit more about how he specifically prepares his riders for time trials on days like this. So Dan Bigham is the subject of today's Encuentro del Día. Here he is.
El Encuentro del Día. The meeting of the day.
Dan, you obviously, I don't want to use the word parachute in for these time trials, well, you'll get called in for these days. Tell me, what is your routine, what's your day like? When does it start and what do you do on a day like this?
So it tends to be more of a sort of two-day thing, depends on the race obviously, but I'll come in, 36 to 48 hours before, recon the day before, sometimes by myself, riding it, collecting the course data, not just from an actual like course execution perspective, but actually collecting data on the course, the actual racing line versus what you might get on VeloViewer or Google Maps or whatever mapping software you might be using. So that's quite important to then obviously feedback to the riders on the course, but then also for my models to decide how we're going to pace it, like how fast can somebody take a corner, what's the optimal gear ratio, what wheels and tires, what tire pressures, all that kind of stuff is stuff that we can feed into our models that then we can give the optimal pacing strategy to the rider the night before so they're aware of it, but then also on the day we'll make finer adjustments once we've done the recon, sometimes obviously barriers change, etc. On the whole, it's basically making sure that we execute as perfectly as we can, whether that's equipment choices, making sure that I'm there for a bike check and that the bikes fly through and that we're all good there. And often you get sort of slight changes and tweaks around the regulations or how the UCI might be applying them on a given day, and that kind of falls on me to make sure we make the right decisions off the back of those. And then being here and present for riders, questions obviously come up about what they should do, and they wonder, okay, is that really the right gear ratio? Should we go this way? And then I can present the data to them, try and explain and justify why we think we should go in a certain direction. And 99% of the time the riders really buy into that. Sometimes obviously there's a bit more of a deeper discussion to be had, but it's just being there, being that person that hopefully the team can trust, and I can answer those questions a bit more objectively than most.
And based on conversations with people in the past, I remember around the hour record, people doesn't seem to be someone who likes to be sort of overwhelmed with information. Can you just tell me about the process of what's the key sort of pep talk? Is it an hour on the bus have you had this morning with him? What does that look like, the sort of final briefing, the key briefing with him?
So Filippo works really close with his coach, Dario Cioni, and they've got a really good relationship. Dario's not here today, but pretty much always he otherwise would be. That is primarily actually just discussing the equipment choices, gearing, tyres, tyre pressures, a few other things around skin suits, helmets, etc. But beyond that, then it's the pacing plan. How are we going to actually tackle this race? We have some really good in-house developed software around that we can be confident in objectively saying you should ride at this power here, and this power there. And it's just agreeing that with the rider, because sometimes it does stretch a rider, and having the confidence to say, yes, I can do that, or no, I can't. For example, today we've got to climb about a third of the way through, and you've got to ride that climb pretty hard, but you've also got two thirds of the time trial to come, and there's that balancing act of, well, how much do you really push there versus how much do you want to put down later? So kind of those discussion points and making sure that we're all happy and agreed on what that is, and then also the feedback they want to receive on the day. Some riders are sometimes more open on some days than others on what they want to hear, how they want to hear it, do they want to hear from the time check, do they not, all those kind of things. They want to hear feedback from other riders' performances, do they want to go in the car with another rider. So all those kind of discussion points you just want to go through and sign off. Try not to really like encroach on riders and what they want to do. Some guys will literally just sit on the bus, watch some TV or play around on their phone. Some guys, yeah, want to sit and chat and talk about every single detail or just shoot the breeze. So, yeah, it's trying to strike that balance, and every rider is different, but they're all in the same area. So you want to kind of not encroach, but at the same time be present enough to help them and to answer their questions and just make sure that they're, yeah, well looked after alongside the rest of the team who are doing their jobs at the same time.
And just finally, Dan, presumably, you know, there are courses where you have an idea of a pacing strategy, but there are some riders, I guess, who always prefer like more of, I don't know, a negative split rather, and that's just part of their, well, psychology.
Yeah, it's where objectivity meets subjectivity, and it's a constant battle, and I don't profess to know the true answer of how we should ever tackle that, because, yeah, some riders prefer riding one way over another, and courses like this do, let, on the objectivity side, lend themselves to a positive split, but we know as well subjectively it's nicer to ride a negative split, and often actually you can achieve a better performance that way. So it's definitely a hard one, and it's, yeah, it's rider by rider really, having those discussions and understanding quite how far they want to push it one way or another, and being able to say, okay, well, if you ride it like this, we think mathematically that might cost you 3 seconds, which is, call it 2 watts or whatever it might be on the course, and then you can kind of make those trade-offs, and they can think it through in their head, and hopefully you come to a happy medium.
Well, Filippo's, oh no, he's still warming down. You better go in a second, Dad. Will you be in the car?
Yes, I'll be in the car.
Yep. Barking instructions? Is that your style?
No, that's Steve. Steve, obviously, as lead DS, he has a closer relationship with the riders day in, day out, so they're just familiar with his voice, how he says things. I don't want to come in and disrupt that. With some riders, I've done it previously. Famously, actually, with Tom earlier at the Algarve, back in whenever that was, when he went off-roading at the roundabout. Yeah, that was me on the radio. I did tell him left. But yeah, I'm more, I guess, behind the scenes than I am really on the radio. I'm happy to, but not really my place right now.
Have a good day. Thanks a lot, Dan. Thanks. So, Lionel, obviously worked pretty well, worked very smoothly for Ineos Grenadiers today. Filippo Ganna doing a pretty virtuoso ride. Remco Evenepoel, we heard him earlier talk about how he wasn't feeling at his best today. But if we move on now to talk about the general classification, I'd persuaded myself before today, but I certainly felt after today's time trial that, you know, they call it the race of truth, and what it delivered today is real gospel truth, in the sense that it told us that Jonas Vingegaard, who lost over a minute to Remco Evenepoel, we knew his preparation hadn't been at the level that his preparation was for the Tour de France. He hadn't been to altitude and so on and so forth, and we'd sensed over the last few days that he might just be hanging on a little bit on some of the climbs. I think it confirmed that his form is not great. I don't think he's completely out of the picture. I don't think Remco Evenepoel can count him out. I think Primoz Roglic is the one of the three that most people think are the favourites now: Vingegaard, Roglic and Evenepoel. I think Roglic slightly overperformed my expectations. I think Remco was maybe he sort of went round in level par, and Vingegaard was over par. That was my reading of it. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, Vingegaard, he's certainly not the same level of kind of aggression as we saw in the Tour de France, where he blasted out of the start gate and basically had it wrapped up right at the start. It's very difficult, I would imagine, to be at that level for two Grand Tours, pretty much back to back, only a few weeks between them. So not such a surprise. Roglic, I think, it's for Jumbo-Visma, it's sort of answered a few questions, hasn't it? And in a way, it brings Jonas Vingegaard into play in a slightly different way, I think, because now he is behind Roglic and they still have Kuss in the jersey. Now, Kuss can kind of defend and just follow and doesn't have to do much. Roglic can kind of just hunt gaps here and there and time bonuses and just do what Roglic does. And Vingegaard is just, I think they could sit tight for a little while and you know, if there is a day where they want to really try and, you know, throw the kitchen sink at it and get him back into play, he could be a kind of wild card option. Perhaps not, other than the Tourmalet stage, maybe there isn't the terrain for that sort of ride.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
By a rider like Vingegaard, I don't know. It would be really, because he's ridden such kind of conventional Grand Tours so far, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And is he an ambush style of rider? He's not a Contador, is he? In that sense of just trying.
Well, hasn't needed to
he
be.
He hasn't need.
Hasn't no, needed to be no, thus
very
far.
Very true. He hasn't needed to be. But that's what makes it so interesting. You know, the result sheet. You would think that the Jumbo-Visma fork, you know, one of the prongs is slightly bent out of shape, maybe, but actually it could play to their advantage, and they still are in an incredibly strong position. I mean, they've got Evenepoel completely surrounded, and really the onus is on Remco, even though he is ahead of Roglic narrowly. He's got to work out a way to try and crack Sepkus, and, you know, Sepkus is not going to be easy to crack. And I think, well, if you're talking about golf, as I mean, he definitely won under par today, I think. Maybe even two under par.
Oh, no. Oh, I think 5, 6, 7 under par. We talked about him losing 7 seconds per kilometre to Remco Evenepoel. That was using Alicante last year as our barometer. He lost 3 seconds a kilometre to Remco Evenepoel, more or less, today.
We need to get our golf scoring. I'm thinking per hole. You're thinking per round.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm thinking course record. This was course record material. I'm thinking Sepkus shot 62.
Yeah. Oh, a sensational ride by him, and really, you know, deserves the backing, really, until he starts to crack. And I don't want to kind of project a personality onto him based on, you know, a few interactions with him over the years, but he strikes me as a kind of honest to a fault type of rider, in the sense that he's not going to put his own ambition ahead of the team if it comes to the point where he feels like he's running out of juice. And Roglic is his status in the team is such that they will know instinctively the moment when, you know, Kuss sort of hands the rein over to Roglic. I would have thought they're not a team that is going to allow a sort of any kind of internal fracture to happen. So I mean, they're in a fantastic position, but I do wonder whether UAE Team Emirates will be thinking that they've got something that they can throw at it over the middle week of the Vuelta. And I wonder what you thought of Marc Soler's performance, because, you know, don't want to go on the golf analogy too far, but he had a fantastic round as well, and still 26 seconds off Sepkus, but, you know, a nice advantage over Evenepoel, and, you know, he's a very good climber. He's not going to be dropped easily.
No, I mean, if we're going to continue with the very strained golf analogies, I see Marc Soler as sort of John Daly of the World Tour. We talked about Remco Evenepoel inviting drama or being stalked by drama everywhere he goes the other day, and the same certainly applies in a different way, in slightly more slapstick fashion usually. Same goes for Marc Soler, doesn't it? But there were no disasters that befell him today. It was a pretty regulation performance from him. He did a ride that ordinarily, if you look at the precedents, would have given him the red jersey today. So that's going to be interesting. And, you know, I just find myself wondering about Sepkus now. I'm unfortunately, for those Sepkus fans and evangelists out there, I still think it's unlikely that he's going to win the Vuelta a España. But I do find myself wondering, where is it that he is going to lose the time? Because we don't have, in the same way that, you know, Sepkus, we talked about him, his previous time trials, then they weren't a good gauge. They weren't a good guide because, well, we heard before the time trial today, he never trains on his time trial bike. He's barely ever ridden a time trial full gas. So we didn't really have too much in the way of a form book. And similarly, there's been this pattern with Sepkus of losing time, getting gapped on sort of explosive finish. Typically, when Roglic roglifies a stage, Sepkus sort of leaks time in the last couple of kilometers, last 2 or 3 kilometers. But often that's because it's been his job to tee Roglic up.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so we don't really know. If Remco, if he does have a target on his back, Sepkus, and Remco is looking, and Sudal Quickstep are looking for somewhere to eliminate him before they concentrate on Roglic, I don't know where it's going to be. It might just be a case of attrition and Sepkus having a bad day, because that's not something Sepkus has ever had to do either. Put together 21 consecutive good days,
yeah,
or reasonable,
yeah,
days.
And I mean, I don't want to sound the doom and gloom, but with the uphill finish tomorrow, it's a sort of day, and I'm not saying that this will happen to Sepkus, but it's a sort of day where a rider really pulls something out of the bag in a time trial to hold onto the jersey very impressively, all of that emotional energy spent as much as the physical energy, and then it's kind of back to the day job terrain where really you would think Sepkus will have no trouble at all, but there's just something that kind of, you know, like a bolt that suddenly comes loose, and before you know it riding on the defensive. And I suppose that would be the scenario where Jumbo-Visma would then have to have a very clear plan about who's going to do the riding where and when, because they don't want Roglic in a team role, I wouldn't have thought, whereas Vingegaard they could press into service to defend the jersey for Kuss, but like I said before, I don't think Kuss is going to turn his team inside out and cost their chances of the overall win just to defend his jersey. He will, I think, flip into his usual role should that moment come. But now it's about who's going to open it up and take the race on to Jumbo-Visma, because really they are so much in control that they don't actually have to do anything.
Lionel, speaking of Americans, I'm going to stitch up our favourite American now, a regular contributor to the Cycling Podcast, Larry Walbass, the Motown maestro. Larry, you're not going to hear it here because this was off mic, off the record, in fact, but I'm going to stitch him up. Larry thought that Seb was going to lose the jersey today, because I spoke to Larry after his time trial, and at that point there was a yawning chasm between Filippo Ganna and the rest of the field, and looking at that, based on that, Larry thought that Seb was really going to struggle to keep the jersey, which is not to say that he wanted him to lose the jersey. He didn't. He was rooting for his fellow countrymen. However, that brings us to today's instalment of, what are we calling it? Arriba. something along those lines. It's Larry's postcard from Spain. Here he is, lucky Larry Walbass, the Motown maestro.
Arriba, Larry Walbass. Andale, andale.
He wants Larry. The Quickstep boys only did 3:10. Wow. James Noxon.
Yeah, but he's tiny. I mean, little dude, little watts, right?
You know, big linebacker yourself.
I feel like by cycling standards these days, I'm pretty big now.
How was the course, Larry? How was your day out there?
I mean, actually, it was super nice. Super nice course. Like, yeah. I mean, we weren't like going for the win, you know. So, I would say I just gave it about 90%. So, like, didn't kill myself, but rode by feeling and felt okay, actually, so that's good.
If we look upon these last 2 days as kind of days for a bit of recuperation, have you got out of them what you wanted to get out of them, what you need to get out of them for the week coming, do you think, do you hope?
I'll tell you this coming week if I feel good or not, but yeah, it's hard to know, you know. I mean, I think, you know, you try to recover as best you can, but still a hard race, so yeah, I mean, yeah, you do everything possible and you hope to come out the other side better than you went in, you know? But yeah, I think it'll be good.
How's the journey? Were you in the unfortunate plane or not?
No, I was in the more fortunate plane, so we were pretty lucky. Because, yeah, I mean, actually, ours was totally flawless, pretty much. Aside from our bus being parked about 300 meters under crazy downpour, further than all the other buses in the rain, but when we got there. But yeah, I mean, I talked to some people on the other plane, and sounded like a pretty brutal experience. So, you know, it sucks. It's like, I mean, there's no one that you could blame for that. You know, it's like, you know, I think the organization, I know they've been catching a lot of flack and stuff, but I mean, that was totally out of their control. You know, it's like they do the best they could do there. And, you know, I know they got a lot of heat this last week, but I mean, that one, I mean, it sucks, you know, and it's easier for me to say because I was on the other plane, but like, you know, I still think it's, I feel kind of bad for the organizer because, like, you know, it's just thing after thing, and this one was really out of their control.
Larry, I'll let you go in a second. Just one more thing on that, the organizers and the issues there have been. What was your view of the previous day and how slippy, how dangerous the road was or wasn't?
I mean, it was pretty slippery. We also have kind of slippery tires, but yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, you know. It's like I was talking to one of the photographers in the race yesterday, and I mean, he put up a good point. He's like, oh, so is like, you know, are the leaders' lives more important than Leonard Kamna's, you know, going for the stage win? When you look at it that way, that's, yeah, that's rough, right? But I mean, I think they tried to do the best they could in the, like a last minute situation, but I mean, I think if they were going to neutralize it, they probably should have just put the finish line at 2K to go rather than whatever they did, because that was kind of a mess.
That's tricky as well, though, isn't it? With all the, they have to move cameras and so on and so forth. It's not easy.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and then, you know, I don't know if the little two huts at the top paid a lot of money for the finish there. At least they tried to do something, I guess, right? But yeah.
Larry, off you go. Enjoy your evening. We certainly will. It's the Fiestas de Verano. It's the 10-day summer festival here. It's going off every night, but you won't see any of that. Sorry, Larry.
Oh, yeah, I definitely missed that. But yeah, at least summer's back now. That's good.
Well, Lionel, not Larry. That was our loyal correspondent, Mr. Warbass. A lot of familiar faces at the finish and the start, indeed, today, Lionel. Another good friend of ours, the Lynx of Marbella, Luis Angel Mate, who's been a feature of our Vuelta a España podcast over the last few years. He's not riding because his Euskaltel team weren't invited, but he was buzzing around the team buses in full team kit looking for a ride, I think.
Wow.
Today. Anyway, I gave him a wave and congratulated him particularly on his outstanding performance in the recent Volta a Portugal, where he won a stage and came very close in a couple of other stages. As I said earlier, it was a great atmosphere in Valladolid today. Fantastic crowds, all sorts of people. Miguel Indurain, in fact, Lionel. I spoke to Miguel Indurain, and here he is.
Hoy veremos a ver cómo sale esta crono. Quien salga vencedor de aquí, pues tiene una ventaja, y los demás tienen que ir a atacar. Y pues queda Pirineos, queda Tourmalet, queda Larrao.
So Lionel, that was Big Mick, the man himself. He was at the Movistar bus. His old, that's his old team, effectively, isn't it? Reynolds, Banesto, he rode for. And what we heard there was Miguel Indurain telling us that he thought today would tell us who's going to win the Vuelta a España, or at least tell us who's going to have to attack now, who's going to have to defend. He says the climbs that we've got coming this week are quite different to the ones the riders have faced so far. That was quite typical of Indurain, wasn't it? Always very diplomatic, wasn't he? Always very kind of ambivalent, non-committal in his career, wasn't he? Certainly in interviews.
El ritmo de la Vuelta. The rhythm of the Vuelta.
That brings us neatly, Lionel, to El Ritmo de la Vuelta, in which we squeeze into our spandex leotards and tear through the space-time continuum a la, well, Filippo Ganna across the plains of Castilla y León. And in our case, going back, not forward, to discover the official anthems of graced or disgraced Vueltas of yesteryear. Today is very relevant to Indurain, Lionel, because the year is 1996. The backing track was Morena, or Brunette. Quote Spanish cycling blog El Tío de Mazo, the most WTF official song in Vuelta history. Why? Well, because the performers Ana Obregón and Ramón García were about as well known for their singing prowess as Primoz Roglic is for his roundabouting. Obregón was a household name as an actress and game show host, and García was also a television presenter. Judge for yourselves whether their one-off musical dalliance was a success. Estás morena, nena, nena, como el chocolate.
What they did do is put their voices to a memorable edition of the Vuelta after it switched to September dates the previous year. The 96 race started in Valencia and was tipped by many to be a redemptive journey for Indurain, who had seen his half-decade streak in the Tour de France end at the hands of Bjarne Riis a couple of months earlier. And he was also going for his first ever victory in his home Grand Tour. Alas, though weary, demotivated, at loggerheads with his team since the start of the season, Big Mig bowed out on stage 13, pulling into the car park of Hotel El Capitan at the foot of the Lagos de Covadonga and out of the race, having begun the day third on GC. Little did anyone, indeed even Indurain, know at the time it was the last race of his career, the last day of his career. In his absence in the final week, a rider many had tipped as his successor, the Swiss ruler Alex Zülle, finally prevailed ahead of Laurent Dufour and Tony Rominger, making it an all-Swiss podium. Equally remarkable, seen through a 2023 lens, Italian riders won 11 of 22 stages. Feels a very long time ago, doesn't it, Lionel?
It does.
Although we had an Italian stage winner today.
There we go. Yeah, and the Swiss kind of infatuation with the Welter in the mid-90s. Rominger won, Zülle won, as you say, Dufault there on the podium. It was an interesting period, that, wasn't it? The race moving. It didn't really find its feet for, I didn't think, as a spectator. I was just watching on Eurosport and reading in cycling magazines at the time. But it all felt... It was all... just wasn't quite right, but it settled into the place now, hasn't it?
Well, it has, and well, we've been very positive about the Vuelta in recent years, haven't we? And the last 10 days or so have been a pretty rough start, certainly to this year's edition, and particularly for Javier Guillen, the race organizer, the race director. I mean, we heard Larry earlier, Lionel, sort of exonerating the organisation. As you heard in the interview, I'm sort of inclined to be sympathetic and charitable, as Larry was. It was a bit of a mess, shall we say, literally and figuratively, on Sunday. I made the point that Larry also made in that interview, that it was a sort of, well, but by moving the GC finish line effectively and having a different finish line for them and the stage win, it was almost as though the organisers were saying, well, the GC battle is much more important than the battle for stage wins, when most of the field comes to the Vuelta a España only for stage wins. And I suppose more simply than that, it just doesn't make the sport look very good at all. But Lionel, I also think that if there is an enemy in all of this, it is, and you know, no particular individual on social media, but I do feel that social media has a big role to play in cycling sending out this image, this chaotic image of, you know, when there are issues, which there often are in professional cycling, also because of things like climate change. I do feel that the sort of prevailing mood, the prevailing wind in social media, it kind of pollutes the decision-making process, and decisions have to be made very quickly, and they're exposed to the gaze of social media, and they're exposed to, well, the ability people have now to watch video, re-watch video, slow it down, share it, and criticize effectively. And when you do start trying to take corrective action in the course of, for example, a stage or an afternoon, then it does start to look very messy.
Yeah, I also, you know, I talked at length about this on Sunday's episode from the vantage point of sitting at home watching it on television. I think the disconnect is that there's just, as I said, there. Think the chaos isn't explained sufficiently well to the broadcasters, who then can pass on that information to people watching, and so there are always more questions than answers. And I think maybe sort of patience and attention spans and a desire for clarity, you know, has intensified over recent years. I mean, the sport is absolutely, you know, the sort of the archaeology of the sport is you know, dig down through the layers of cycling history, and it is a sport of chaos and controversy and you know, finish lines being moved and you know, results being switched, and you know, riders not knowing, you know, what's going on around them. And I think because we watch on TV and it all appears very, very clear in 2D, we forget that it's a massive, complicated rolling circus. You know, we see it sometimes when races, the courses are changed and people get the maps up and go, well, why can't they go, you know, cut that road out and just do that climb instead? Not understanding the extent of the planning and the extent of the infrastructure and just how difficult it is to close roads and ensure the safety and security of the course and all the rest of it. So the organisers and the commissaires are always making the least bad decision that they can with the riders. And I do think, you know, Adam Hansen and the CPA deserve some credit for at least forcing the decision to be made from the point of view of the safety of the riders. And I suppose, you know, in the quest for perfection, we will have imperfect solutions as we had the other day. So yeah, I feel, you know, the rest day I've chilled out a bit. I mean, I spent the second hottest day of the British summer watching a time trial, for goodness sake, and that didn't dampen my mood. So, you know, let's look forward to the rest of the Vuelta and kind of, I suppose, yeah, embrace the chaos of the sport, because that is what you know, what we've all enjoyed over the years. You know, I'm not necessarily saying that Sunday stage will be one that we're talking about in 20 years time, but it will be one of those sort of curious ones. The Daniel Freiber of the future will be mentioning stage 9 of the 2023 Vuelta, yeah, where they, you know, they carried the stage winners just carried on and the GC riders just rolled over the line doing their warm down. And it will be one of those curious things consigned to the history of the sport, you know, a checkered, yeah, but fascinating history.
Yeah, I think the key difference being that the evidence, the key sort of evidence, the most 3D evidence, like the TV pictures, or 2D pictures, once upon a time they would disappear into the ether in a split second and it was very difficult to revisit them, whereas now that's very, very easy. The advent, for example, of, well, GCN's fantastic coverage and the fact that you can do all of that on your mobile phone, I think that makes a massive difference. I think we should remember that when criticising the organisers, that we simply didn't have the ability to do that. Very, very recently.
Yeah, and just on that, I mean, we often see it, don't we, from sports directors who make the point that the TV pictures that they are watching in the team car are delayed compared to the ones that we're watching on TV, because obviously, you know, they're going, you know, up and down and bouncing around here and there. And so the whole sport is kind of operating on, you know, analog in a digital era. Just on that, actually, we had an email from Christopher Duffy who asked, he asked about this question of riders complaining that their radios haven't worked or haven't been able to hear the communications. Surely the tech now exists to ensure stable comms during a race. It's such an important part of racing, so why can't they get it right, he asks.
This has always baffled me. This has always baffled me. And it has been, it does not seem to have advanced one iota in 25 years.
Maybe not, but you're still talking about signals that have to travel in broadly straight lines. So, and when you watch the race from the roadside and you appreciate how far behind the peloton the team cars are often, you know, when they're going round through, you know, round a hillside, or it could be that the riders are on the other side of the kind of little lump of land to the team cars. And if you, well, you've probably sat in team cars as well, Daniel, the communication is scratchy, it's difficult to hear. Heaven knows what it's like actually for the riders with an earpiece just taped into their ear. Yes, it's fairly rudimentary tech, but I guess it is the best that they have got, but it's certainly not flawless, far, far from it. And so, yeah, I think we have this idea that everybody's wired up for sound and everybody knows where every rider is. It just isn't the case. But yeah, it's all part of that kind of semi-controlled chaos that is Grand Tour racing.
Lionel, we are, well, in danger of shooting way over par in the time trial that is, well, our efforts to get this, the length of this episode, under an hour. So I propose we're going to dispense with the usual jingle. We're just going to very quickly tell you what we've got in store tomorrow. I'm going to very quickly tell you that last night we had a fantastic dinner with our colleagues from TV2, our friends from Danish television, Søren and Nick the cameraman. And that's always, it's one of the great pleasures, isn't it, Lionel, of Grand Tour coverage doing Grand Tours on the ground, the ability to meet up and, you know, bounce ideas off each other, mostly, sadly, tragically, some would say, talk about cycling. Lionel, the stage tomorrow. Dan Martin, our good friend Dan Martin, won here last time, didn't he?
He did. 2020, ahead of Roglic and Carapaz, so it's a finish ripe for a time bonus type sprint. The stage goes from Lerma to La Laguna Negra Vinuesa, 163 kilometres. The uphill finish, it's a first category climb, 6.5 kilometres long at an average of 6.7%. So it's going to be the next big test of Jumbo-Visma and of Sepp Kuss. And we're going to see whether anyone else is going to lay a card on the table tomorrow. Let's hope somebody tries something, because there are enough teams in there that could throw the gauntlet down to Jumbo-Visma.
It's very beautiful. It's very remote. It's going to look great from the helicopter tomorrow. I vividly remember being at that finish a couple of years ago, or when Dan Martin won. It's ripe for Roglification, I would suggest, although a break might be allowed to go down the road as well. Lionel, we're going to play out tonight with the latest installment of James Knox's audio diary. He's reporting back from the rest day. If you have any questions for James you would like answered in the podcast, then tell us on social media, or you can also write directly to James. He told me this afternoon Instagram is fine. Just reply to one of his Instagram pictures, reels,
or email us directly, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And in fact, it was a great question from Christopher Duffy, and if you do have any other questions, we might not answer them during this Vuelta, but once the Grand Tour season is over, maybe we'll do a post-bag episode at some point. So if you've got a question, contact@thecyclingpodcast, whether for us or for James Knox.
Here's James. Good night.
So here we are, first rest day, made it this far. We're a bit outside Valladolid now, really in that Ribera del Duero wine region, in amongst all that. So yeah, it was a big day yesterday. A lot of stress even in the neutral, already windy, 7 kilometres in, turned left out of some villages, big wide open road, crosstail from the right. Jumbo just threw it in the gutter, and yeah, it was really hard. I've never gone so hard in the gutter for a few minutes. It was maybe only 2 minutes in the end. Thought I was making it into the front group. It was about 30 guys. Looked up and saw 15 guys just riding off into the distance. So that was pretty terrifying. I was way over my limit. It was the start of the race. I just pulled out the parachute and went backwards for a bit. Went back to third group, came back to the second group. There was a big frantic chase there all the way. Must have been a good 50 kilometres of Movistar, Bahrain, EF, UAE, FDJ. Real chaos from behind, trying to chase the break. Oh, not the break, the front split with Remco and all the guys at Jumbo. We then got to the first climb of the day and it all packed up. And even though from behind we came really, really, took the start of the climb all out, got to the front and then everyone started looking, and then the breakaway went and the road was quickly blocked. And we went very slowly up the climb in the end. Very slowly downhill because it was pretty treacherous. Everyone, I think I was told afterwards there was even some crashes, but we were going down really, really slowly. And then there was another crosswind section, 95 kilometres in, I think. And out of fear for what had happened for the first time, we were pretty determined to try and do something. So even though the Jumbo guys were on the front saying, we're not going to do anything, I did a bit of work trying to keep the guys in front and positioning. And then as we turned right, this time up a little drag, the guys had clear road on the left to put it in the gutter and, yeah, make another split, which then have also got brought back. But it was a really hard day, even, you know, forgetting what was to come. At this moment, we've been going pretty on-off, all-out, going easy, all-out, going easy. So it was, starting to feel the legs. And then the sort of main peloton sort of formed on the next climb, when the group from behind went again all out to come back to the front of the race. And then it chilled out, really. Jumbo just rode a steady pace. Big drag race into the bottom of the climb. Cataneo did a big job for Remco. And in amongst all that, at about 25k to go, we got news over the radio that the finish line for the GC would be at... I heard 2.6k to go, but I think in the end it was like 2.2k to go. So quite a confusing day. But anyway, up ahead, the breakaway stayed away and Kamna got his hat trick for the Grand Tours, which was pretty cool. It was just a bit madness, really, wasn't it? Thinking how much happened all in one stage there. But we stayed out of trouble. Obviously, crosswinds are pretty dangerous. There was quite a lot of crashes in the start. Vavaka actually did crash. So, oh, what am I saying? But he seems okay. And then, after the race, down to a sports centre, showered, food. Buses from the organisation to Valladolid, because our bus had driven from the start all the way to the Valladolid airport. Took our flight, which went smoothly, despite the rain when we landed in Valladolid. And the second plane, which took off 10-15 minutes after us, didn't make it and got rerouted to Madrid. So I feel for those guys, because that sounds pretty awful. And they got in pretty early in the morning. So yeah, quite 24 hours. Rest day hasn't been special, but we're in a very nice hotel. It was raining this morning, so just went on the rollers for a little roll around. I just did as little as possible. I think I managed 15 minutes of pedaling, which must be a record waste of time, to be honest. But just to turn the legs over, tomorrow's another rest day for me, 25k time trial, so just taking that as... turn the legs over today for absolutely no reason and then keep it going tomorrow. But it was kind of under wraps as well, but the other notable thing was I was pretty sick after stage 3. I had a bad tummy, couldn't really eat or drink anything on stage 4, but we had a easy day. Was really, really suffering. I think there's just a gastro bug that went round, and I was actually 3 kilos lighter from the morning of stage 3 to the morning of stage 5. So my body went through quite a bit of trauma there, but got through and feeling back to normal now. So no complaints, but happy to have made it through that tough patch. But I have to acknowledge I got lucky with the easy stages that came there from stages 4 and 5, where the brake rolled out pretty easy, the terrain was pretty easy. I could just sit in the back and, suffer.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Burnham.